Accession number 18477, Reel 2.
Frank, call it Reel 2.
Right. We never really bored, but at the same time, I was brought up in an era of where there was no class distinction, or at least colour prejudice, I should really say, because the fact that it was only in sort of during the war that I'd ever seen my first coloured man, that it ever entered my head about people being different. And I've never, ever had any colour prejudice, never will do, because to me, the man is the man you talk to. The colour doesn't come into it. So therefore, I mean, there are some very nasty people about, but and you'll get them in every race and every creed. There's nothing you can do about that. If somebody wants to believe in that sort of thing, then they believe in it. I didn't.
Did you see much of the conflict between Jew and Arab in Palestine?
Oh, yes. Yeah, I mean, it was a daily occurrence to hear that a bomb had gone off in a cafe here, or a bomb had gone off in Haifa. Very, very often, I mean, you would hear it at night time, you know, different gunfights and things like that. It was quite. I think, having said what I have said, the during the nights, you never really got what you could call a really good night's sleep, because there was always something happening. And you would you'd always be alert. I think this is the thing, actually. You were always there thinking, right, I'm going to be ready if anything happens. And that was it.
Did you have any other duties apart from driving the scout car?
Oh, yes. I mean, you've all done your own tour of duties, you know, like standing guard and all that sort of thing. You had your 24-hour guards and things like that. And you also done recces through the different villages. You had to do your own patrols, and that through Haifa and Rafa and Jaffa, all over those places.
What did you see on the patrols?
Well, we used to enjoy ourselves, actually. We used to go scrumping oranges. But, no, it was, they could be interesting. You would stop and you would, or you'd get stopped by somebody that turned around and said that there was a terrorist around the corner or something like that. You would go and investigate that. Unfortunately, I never got to see one of these terrorists. But that was just one of those things.
So it sounds as though the artillerymen were acting in an infantry role then?
Oh, yes. Yes, it wasn't a case where you could, I mean, you couldn't sort of go and drag 25-pounders into into Haifa. I wouldn't say they were actually obsolete, but it was just one of those things. You didn't have the call for it. You do exercises, obviously, to keep in trim. You'd have to do the schemes, you know, that they used to go on to. And we would go out into the desert or somewhere like that and do a couple of nights on a scheme. No, it was never a dull moment.
Now, were you in Palestine when it became Israel in May 1948?
Yes, in May 1948 we were then sent over to Tripoli by LST. We went over by LST to Tripoli. And we were stationed at a place called Homs, which was about 10 or 11 kilometres, about 10 to 15 kilometres away from Tripoli.
This is in the Lebanon?
Yes. Well, as it is known now, yes. It was all part of Tripoli at the time, wasn't it?
What did the unit do at Homs?
Well, it was basically, again, it was a security attachment, really. Keeping an eye on things as, in general. It was really a policing job, really.
Was there any trouble there?
Oh, there was the odd bit of trouble, but it wasn't anything like Palestine. Nothing about that at all, really. It was nothing like that at all. We had more relaxation there than anywhere that we had in Palestine. We would go down to, there was always a Liberty truck to go down to Tripoli, to the big Nafi that was there at the time. There were one or two bits of trouble in there, you know, between rivaling sort of groups of British soldiers. You know, you always get a little bit of trouble, a couple of fights, nothing really big, you know, one or two arguments started up or something like that. But I also spent 5 days leaving a place called Maserata. We went tuna fishing up there with a friend of mine, a bloke named Percy Stokes, who unfortunately died in 1952.
Did you spend the rest of your service?
I spent the rest of my service in
this area?
In Homs, and that's where I was demobbed from. I came back to England and was demobbed in England.
Now, you said that you decided to rejoin the army.
Well, I came out of the army and had a couple of jobs, one up the factory and another couple of odd jobs, nothing particular. And then I decided to go back in the army, which was early 1950.
Why had you decided to go back to it?
I just felt civilian life wasn't for me, sort of thing.
So you went back as a regular?
Yes. Yeah, I signed on for 3 years at the time.
In the early part of 1950?
Yes.
Which unit did you join?
I joined the 1st Royal Tank Regiment.
For what reason?
Because that's what I wanted to be. I just felt that that's what I would like to do, is to join the Royal Tanks.
Why not the Royal Artillery again?
I never really can honestly say I never really enjoyed myself. I didn't want to go back into the artillery. No particular reason. It's just that I didn't feel that's what I wanted to do. I wanted a change, and that was it.
You were telling me something earlier off the record about the comradeship that you found in the RTR.
Oh, yes, yes. I joined the RTR at Catterick. Not the first RTR at the time, it was just the Royal Armoured Corps, to do basic training. And because I'd already been in the army before, they put me in charge of a hut, 20 men, sort of thing. I also got out of a lot of the normal basic training that they did because of my previous service, and done little jobs like squadron runner and anybody's boot boy, sort of thing. Not bad little jobs, right? You know, travelling around in the jeep or driving this, that and the other. And of course, the only thing I had to do and learn was tank driving. And I thoroughly enjoyed my time up in Catterick. I was up there for 8 weeks. And so I thoroughly enjoyed that. And I'd done my 8 weeks up there. And then I came home on leave, and I think I went back there for another 2 weeks And then I got embarkation leave for Germany because I'd already been posted to the 1st Royal Tank Regiment. And it was just before then. In actual fact, it was on my, before I actually signed on the army, that I'd met my wife, Anne. I actually met her in, she was 14, when I, no, 15 when I went to the shop. I used to deliver the papers for Smiths and Sons, the wholesalers. I used to go and deliver papers to the shop where she used to work. And of course, I found out not long after we were married and things like that, that she'd actually turned around to her manageress, and I hadn't even been out with her, and I hadn't, apart from speaking to her, and she said, I'm going to marry him one day. And little did I know that I'd ever marry her, but there you are. And we had a bit of a courtship when I was on leave and on embarkation leave. And then I went over to Germany, and we was at a place called Detmold. I found that a rather exhilarating sort of posting. It was, I thoroughly enjoyed myself there. Of course, I did forget to mention it. All my time in the army, I was in the boxing team. And of course, I was in the boxing team in the regiment at Detmold. And at the time that I was serving there, Randolph Turpin, who was then the world middleweight champion, he came to visit us on the night that I was boxing on that particular show. And he gave out the prizes on that particular show. Very memorable evening.
How did the British soldiers regard serving in Germany in 1950?
I think there was a lot of, I personally, I mean, I couldn't care less about what happened. I mean, I was a little bit against Germans in general. And I think that the whole, well, at least the majority of squaddies that were with me had this sort of thing about Germans because of what they did during the war. And I think it would be a long, long time before they're ever really forgiven for that. But nevertheless, we had a job to do, and we done it to the best of our ability, I think. And it was then, when I was in Germany, that I really found the camaraderie. Because it was then that I'd actually got assigned to a tank in an actual squadron. You get to know your team. And I was very, very fortunate. We had a brilliant first lieutenant that was my tank commander, a bloke named Mickey Farmer. A brilliant man, obviously destined to go a long way. And although I can't recall the actual names of all of my team now, I don't know why, but he stuck out in my memory. But whereas the others, I can remember. One of the blokes' names, Rawlins, was one of the blokes in the team, but I can't remember the others. Maybe this is my age, I don't know.
What kind of tanks were you driving?
The Centurion Mark III's.
What can you tell me about what they were like to operate?
They were brilliant. I think, to be honest and truthful, I think they were one of the best tanks that were ever produced, and that's including against the Challenger as it is now. I've seen the Challenger, and I still think that the Centurion was the most versatile and comfortable tank if you can call any tank comfortable, there was certainly worse tank. I found it comfortable to drive. Space was a little bit limited, I'm afraid. I wouldn't get back into a Centurion now. I'm a little bit too big now for that. But a very versatile and adaptable tank.
Did it have any faults?
Not that there were faults in the first Centurions they bought out, but they all seem to have been what's the word I'm looking for?
Ironed out.
They all seem to have been ironed out, and as I say, the Mark III, it was a very, very adaptable tank.
How, in the event, did you get on with the German population?
I got on all right with them. I still think that, looking back on my time in Germany there, that although the British had this thing about the Germans, I still think there was a lot of conflict there. You know, it didn't take long then for an argument to develop if you were that way inclined. But having learned my lessons on what happens when you're in the wrong, I decided very much so to turn the other cheek, as you might say.
Did any incidents occur that you witnessed or were part of?
No, I didn't witness any. I heard more than what I witnessed. I heard more about the fights that went on and things like that, but I never witnessed any of them.
Presumably, you were there in case there was a conflict with the Russians.
Did
you think that was going to occur?
Well, yes. I think it was on everybody's mind that might... There was always that talk that the Russians were never going to be satisfied with just staying behind that wall. And I think that was just built into you. You just were aware of that all the time.
Now, how did you come to go to Korea?
Well, we left Detmold and we all came back to Tidworth, and we were given 14 days embarkation leave. And then we went out to Korea on, I think it was the, I can't remember the name of the ship now. I've seen it. I can't remember.
It's all right.
That's how we went. We went out there. We stopped off at Portside and Ceylon just for 48 hours sort of thing, you know, and then carried on. We got into Busan.
When was this that you did this?
This was in 1951. 52.
Do you know which month you arrived in Busan?
I could tell you directly if I get hold of the book, but I can't remember exactly the month. I think it was May or June, I think.
What greeted your eyes when you got to Busan?
Well, I think the hubble and bubble and everything was crowded. Is the word I would say. It was, there wasn't space for everybody sort of thing. It just seemed that everybody was everywhere. It was just a complete shambles, really. And I thought, God, have we got to live through this? And I remember how cold it was at the time.
Sounds as though it wasn't May then. Sounds as though it wasn't May that you arrived, if it was cold.
Well, no, it was cold.
What was this, the whole of the 1st Royal Tank Regiment that arrived?
Well, no, there had been an advance party had gone up there. We were destined to go into Gloucester Valley. It was where the Glossers made their last stand, and it was known as Gloucester Valley, and that's where we held our camp. It was roughly about 15-20 kilometres away from Pusan, I suppose. Not Pusan, Tok Chon. Very desolate. Horrible place, really. Everything was basic. Toilets, there was no such thing as mobile toilets. You had to dig your own and dig these 10-foot deep trenches for toilets. And everything was, we were under canvas as well. Under these big marquee type tents with wooden sides. And we used to sleep on sleeping bags and on the floor, most of it, until we got issued with some camp beds, that type of thing. And there, unless you were on your tour of duty up the front, what you would call the front, which is the action part of it, there wasn't a great deal that you could do. You had to confine yourself to turn around and playing football, or keeping yourself exercised, really, and keeping yourself as fit as you could. They had people there if you wanted to do, I mean, most of it was your own washing and toiletries you'd done yourself. But there were people there if you wanted to get them to do it, Koreans that would do it for you. But it was the coldness. We had nice days, but when the winter was there, it was really cold. And I know for laughs that we used to turn around and take the tops off of beer and stick a stick in them, you know, and stick them outside the door. And then in the morning you'd have a nice beer lolly. You couldn't sort of have a wet shave out there. Because no sooner you got the froth on the face, and that would turn to ice. So we were all issued with, well, not everybody, but to each tank we were issued, I should always remember it, the Contour 60s, a shaving, I forget what the actual name of the firm was.
A razor, you mean?
Yeah, it was an electric razor, and each tank had one. I always remember it, a Remington Contour 60. So you could have a shave, that was okay. But it was the amount of clothing, the clothing, I would say, in fact, I know for a fact it was better than anything the Americans had, because they would do anything to get hold of our parkas and a lot of our clothing. The boots, if I could take you sort of through it, the boots were quite thick, soled. And they came up to just above your ankle, and inside there you would have this sort of wire mesh insole which allowed the air to go around, and you'd have the thick woolen socks on, all wool socks, and then you would wear long johns, and then on top of your long johns you'd have this sort of not felt, a felt type material, that a pair of pants that would go the full length of your appearance. Then you'd have a pair of waterproofs over the top of that, and then you'd have your on the top you'd have a string vest, and you'd have another type of vest tie over the top of that, and then you'd have your shirt and your combat jacket and your combat trousers over the top of that. Then, of course, on top of that, if you had to go in the tanks and that, you'd have your tank suit on, which I've got one upstairs, actually. I mean, in the loft, but very heavy. Well, not heavy, but bulky. But they were comfortable when they were on. Quite a big thing to put into your kit bag, but they were very, very good. And, of course, you had the gloves, which were all... you had nylon... type gloves on the inside, and then you had the woolen gloves on the outside. So really and truly, when you went outside, of course, you on top of that, you had your parka, which was really good, and you could actually turn around. It had this type of wire stuff in the edge of the hood. And you could actually bring it down so it turned around, and actually all you could see was the person's eyes. You could close it right up, you know. So you were well protected from the weather. And the food, what we had there was very, very good, actually. I mean, they done very well with the food there. But if you went like for a breakfast, you know, say it was egg and bacon or something like that, which quite possibly it could be. If you had to walk too far with it, and it would probably stick to your plate because it was that cold. So you had these big space heaters in the dining halls, and a big place, and you stick your, or you warmed your mess tin. You warmed it up on the doing before you got your food in it, so it wouldn't freeze. But it was, it used to freeze that quick. It was very, very good. But, and of course, we had water coming out of a spring up in the side of the mound, and it come right down on a similar sort of thing to Angline. They come down, and you could turn around, and you had to watch out for these. You get a lot of boot-nosed snakes there, very narrow things. So you wouldn't go out there at night time, and you'd like to see what you're getting. But in general, it wasn't, although there was the war on, I think everybody used to make the best of everything out there, you know. And I'll say there was this uniformity amongst the lads, and there was always competition between the different squadrons. So you'd have football A and B squadron would be playing football against each other, and C and D squadron would be playing football against each other, and then you'd have a final between whoever it was, and then you'd also play the Koreans and perhaps the Americans or something, or they're all sport was a good thing there. You had to have it to keep everybody fit, really.
Which squadron and troop were you in?
I was in A squadron.